Thanks for choosing us, The Takeaway, for your listening pleasure. I'm John Hockenberry, and this is today's show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And we had a quiet night in Baltimore for once this week, largely quiet. And it will be very quiet and sad at that Baltimore Orioles makeup baseball game from Monday that will be played today in a stadium closed to the public. Nobody in the seats. The game closed to spectators because of this week's violence, but a curfew was lifted this morning. It's expected to stay in place for a week. Today, people were beginning to clean up in the worst-hit areas. There was that amazing viral video of the mom in the yellow shirt grabbing and slapping her son she recognized dressed in a black ski mask and pulling him out of a crowd of hooligan rioters. CBS News did a whole segment on it called Tough Love. We will talk about tough love for the tough streets of Baltimore and the black-white divides there with actor Wendell Pierce later this hour. Wendell Pierce from The Wire. He will reflect on his time playing a black cop in that HBO series. But when a city erupts, is there a way to chart how we got here? It doesn't take much to turn a thriving city into a collection of isolated enclaves, really. Some real estate map shenanigans, zoning manipulation here and there, gentrification, loss of industry, and the seething anger begins to grow. Joining us is Antero Pietola, who is a Baltimore Sun reporter for 35 years. He's the author of Not in My Neighborhood, How Bigotry Shaped a Great American City. Antero, welcome to The Takeaway.
Greetings from Baltimore, the city of the wire.
City of the wire, that's right. City of a lot more this week. How does bigotry shape a great American city? How do small moves in quiet sort of moments of racial hatred become what seems obvious now as we look at the rioting in the neighborhoods that are black, white, isolated enclaves?
Well, Baltimore's story is a long story. It is the story of many American cities, perhaps not in this type of rioting, but in the history of the city. In 1910, Baltimore became the first American city to require by city council ordinance that each residential block be segregated. That's one milepost. Then in the mid-1930s, the federal government redlines Baltimore and 238 other cities, and that will then guide lending patterns and begin the kind of deterioration of neighborhoods, first during the Great Depression and then Second World War. Baltimore is a very old city, narrow row houses, 14, 16 feet. So during the war, Baltimore's population reached 1.2 million in 1942. In 1968, when we had the previous riots after Martin Luther King's assassination, the city's population was 910,000. Today, it is about 620,000. So there are lots of systemic things that are happening here.
And as the retreat of the population has taken place, has the housing stock been abandoned, been improved? Have there been renovations in neighborhoods, or has it been pretty much left open and abandoned?
All of the above. There have been renovations, but in terms of the housing stock, it is antiquated. Much of it, tens of thousands of units are vacant and boarded up. There is no demand for that type of housing. 40 miles from here is Washington, D.C., I challenge anybody to find any boarded-up houses in D.C. There are no boarded-up houses in Anacostia. There is demand in Baltimore. There is very little demand. Instead, what we have, and this also played in the Freddie Gray incident, is an old housing stock that is poisoned with lead paint, and it has killed the housing resale market. Gray also was involved in a lawsuit in which he alleged that he had become poisoned with lead paint. So this is a major, major problem in Baltimore.
And how does police activity contribute to this? If they're left to basically face all of these problems, not to justify anything that police do, if everything falls on the cops, you're going to have these kinds of incidents. You're going to have violence because if nobody besides the cops are dealing with these social problems, that's going to be the point of just like there's violence in the schools. If it becomes a babysitting service for social problems, that's going to happen that's going to deteriorate the schools as well.
Absolutely. And it's a problem on many, many fronts. For instance, a great, not majority, but almost half of the police department does not even live in Baltimore City. The same for fire. So there is the sense in the communities, not only in black communities, but also in white communities, that the policemen and policewomen, they are outsiders.
And that's true also here in New York. You know, I take the subway to work sometimes. I have an early call here at the station. And, you know, I was noticing at 5 a.m. on the subway, even in New York, and I take the subway all the time, and this is never the case, except at 5 in the morning, it's all black. All black at 5 a.m. And that's this kind of sort of soft, subtle bigotry of who does what, when, and why. And you see that racial segregation even here in New York.
And you see it in Baltimore. I am from Finland originally, and when I ride on Baltimore subway and then in Washington, D.C., 40 miles from here on the same day, I have the sense that in Washington I'm in a totally different country. People look different. They behave different. They are dressed differently. Now, let me return to the demographics. I talked about the cities, the shrinking city. What is also very important, and this comes to play in this incident, is the fact that in the early years, after the 1968 riots and before that, it was white flight. That white flight in Baltimore has been stemmed, but there is a continuing outflow of middle-class blacks, and this is a very serious situation in a city like Baltimore, which really needs demand. It needs people occupying housing, people who are working in working life and are productive members of society.
Are these wheels in motion and can't be stopped, or what turns around a city like this? There's certainly is, you know, plenty of reason to think that Baltimore can change. It's visible. It's, you know, it's got sports teams. It's, you know, certainly a part of the American conversation.
Well, Freddie Gray came from an area that is now known as Sandtown Winchester. And there has been lots of Habitat of Humanity renovation there. And there was a thinking in the 1980s and 70s that perhaps by giving people a stake in a community, by providing them good housing, that would resolve some of the problems. Of course, in Sandtown, most of the people are unemployed, and that is the key thing in Baltimore, key consideration, key factor, is that people need jobs. And so there is a whole generation of angry black males who may not have had a steady job at all.
What industries left Baltimore, and are there any that could come back? It is a port city.
Well, Baltimore used to be a big manufacturing city. Bethlehem Steel, there were, particularly during the war, there was 50,000 people worked in aircraft manufacturing. All that is gone. There's lots of service industry. Really the thriving poster child for Baltimore's recovery and new frontiers is Under Armour, which is headquartered in Baltimore. But, I mean, there really aren't that many domestic, homegrown businesses in Baltimore. For instance, one fact is that in 1968, when the previous riots were here, there were still some Fortune 500 companies that were headquartered in Baltimore. Today, Baltimore is a branch office town.
Hmm. I didn't realize that Under Armour was based in Baltimore. That's a very high-profile brand. People should know that. Antero, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Antero Pietola was a Baltimore Sun reporter for 35 years. He's the author of Not in My Neighborhood, How Bigotry Shaped a Great American City.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
To live in Jerusalem is to see the most beautiful light in the world, I think. A warm pinkish hue that may come off the distinctive stone everywhere. No one has fully explained it. Everyone has experienced it. Jerusalem is also a place of unspeakable ugliness, violence, religious-motivated intolerance, anger and suspicion amidst love and a spiritual peace found nowhere else in the world. Those contradictions are what I found in Jerusalem when I was there in the 1980s and 90s. Tom Friedman was just ending his famous stint as bureau chief for the New York Times, Joel Brinkley beginning his. In Jerusalem, the New York Times correspondent is like the 5,000-pound gorilla of the International Press Corps. This does not literally describe current bureau chief Jody Rodoran, but she understands the pressure and the scrutiny of her job. She's also experienced two wars in the Gaza Strip, two Israeli national elections, Palestinian success in the United Nations, collapsed peace talks, an impending U.S. nuclear deal with Iran, the Syrian civil war, and unprecedented regional chaos. It's been a remarkable 3 years, and it isn't over yet.
The level of viciousness and personal attacks is really distressing. And it's not just distressing because it hurts me and because people insult my husband and children and threaten them. It's distressing because I think of what it says about the devolution of the debate on this issue. And people are just so unable to empathize or see other people. I wrote a story last week about Memorial Day in Israel. And it was about a woman whose son was killed in the Yom Kippur War in 1973, and how for more than 40 years, people have come to her to a private memorial service every year, even though many of them know many other people who've been killed as well. It's just sustained itself. And I think that happens all over Israel. And also 23 people, more than half of them, not her relatives, have named their kids after her son Gilad. Mm. And I got incredible feedback about the story, that it just felt like it really explained something about Israeli culture and was very powerful. And then I got a message from somebody I work with, a Palestinian official, who said, your lack of empathy for Palestinians is unbelievable. And I couldn't really understand the message because the story wasn't about Palestinians at all. And I asked him, I said, you know, did I not show empathy when I wrote about the Gaza artist? And I pointed out several other, I thought, very empathetic stories about Palestinians. And I realized later that this idea that you can't show empathy for both Israelis and Palestinians, or for both Hamas people and moderate Fatah people, or for Haredi Jews and secular Jews, I think it's really troubling. I mean, I have empathy for all kinds of people, and I don't think that it's a zero-sum game and that showing empathy for one side of a story requires a lack of empathy for another. I don't think that's playing out in other places in the same way.
No, and I think people measure your empathy, that there's a kind of a theoretical idea that there is a perfect balance of empathy. And in a place like Israel, how could you ever even know what such a thing would be?
I mean, I don't think empathy as a thing is measurable at all. But I also feel like this is a big concern I have about this supposed criticism of our coverage is it's constantly takes this kind of scorecard approach, as though a piece of journalism or a political conflict can be measured like a basketball game, and as though the number of words that are coming out of the mouths of an Israeli or Palestinian in a particular newspaper article affects kind of some balance of where the conflict stands. And I think that's just, life is much more complicated than that, really. And, you know, I wrote a story now about a year ago, a little bit less than a year, when the three Israeli teenagers were kidnapped and then killed. This was before their bodies were found. I spent some time with the mother of the American citizen who was among the kidnapped, this really incredible woman, Racheli Frankel. She showed the whole country an incredibly poised way of handling tragedy. And I wrote a story together about her and about the mother of a young Palestinian kid who was killed in the Israeli crackdown in the search for the three boys. And I got a lot of outrage from the right or from Jews about the idea of putting these two mothers together in one story, as though I was saying that their experiences were the same. And I thought, I didn't say they were the same. I just said they were both happening at the same time. Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm. you know, people should know that there are mothers on both sides. And there are things they have in common, and there are things that are totally different about them. And you could read both of them, and you could find empathy with both of them, and you don't have to decide whose situation is worse. Or you can decide. I mean, it's fine to decide who you think is suffering worse or who deserves it or whatever, but Just know what's going on.
And that's something they're bringing to the story, not something you're bringing
exactly,
to the story.
Exactly. Yeah.
Do you think Israel sees an opportunity to resolve matters with the Palestinians or move forward with matters on the Palestinians, given that Syria is in complete chaos and Iraq is in complete chaos and Egypt is not doing terribly well? And, of course, you continue west, Libya is a nightmare. And they've got the Mediterranean, a cemetery, which is what the prime minister of Italy talked about. It seemed like if you could solidify some situation in Israel and the occupied territories, you might have an enclave that would have some security. Do people feel that way at all?
The short answer is no. When I got there in 3 years ago, I feel like there were these kind of two arguments about how the regional changes affected the underlying question of Israel and the Palestinians. And there was one strong camp that said a time of regional chaos is not a time to make any moves. It's more risky to make any moves, and it's a time to kind of hunker down and wait the craziness out, and then we can address these other things. And then there was another camp that really talked about the idea of an island of stability, and maybe if you resolve this basic problem with the Palestinians, it would be a stronger face out to the region. That second camp, I think, has weakened over the last 3 years. There's a slim majority that still supports a two-state solution with the Palestinians. There's a much larger majority that thinks that's impossible. A good chunk of that is attributed to the Palestinian leadership and the idea that they are not a reasonable partner for peace. And another big piece of it is the regional situation, the idea that with the rise of Islamic extremism in other forms, that the threats are just too dangerous to make any moves. And then there's, of course, also a strain, I think a small strain, that just basically believes that the whole river to the sea should be in Israeli or Jewish hands.
Hmm. Jody, thanks so much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Jody Rodoran stopped by our studios on her way back to Israel. She is Jerusalem Bureau Chief for our partner, The New York Times.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Moo, working to help businesses stand out with a range of business cards and printed products for telling a company's unique story. Also offering Printfinity, the ability to print a different image on every card. Learn more at Moo.com.
What's the highest quality waste of an hour? An hour of Angry Birds or Tetris? Super Mario Brothers, Doom, or The Takeaway? Hey. Well, those are among the nominees, not The Takeaway, of course, in an unscientific poll of the world's most popular video games for a new Hall of Fame. The full list comes from the National Museum of Play in Rochester, New York. It is
Angry Birds,
Doom,
FIFA Soccer,
Legend of Zelda,
Minecraft,
The Oregon Trail,
Pac-Man,
Pokemon,
Pong,
The Sims,
Sonic the Hedgehog,
Space Invaders,
Super Mario Brothers,
Tetris,
World of Warcraft.
Compiling votes for the finalists for induction into the new World Video Game Hall of Fame. Winners won't be announced until June. Joining us to sort our winners and losers in the video game is Don Robich, who co-created the first version of the Oregon Trail back in 1971. It's been a while, huh, Don?
Yes, it has.
What makes a legendary, you know, Hall of Fame level video game, and why do you think people connect it to Oregon Trail?
Well, I think that the game has to provide a challenge, and the game has to involve you at a personal level. I've always thought that one of the reasons why the Oregon Trail was so popular is that when it first came out in the version that you could play on a personal computer, you were putting kids right into the middle of a story as well as having them play a game. I think it's that personal connection and the fact that they feel like they're in control of the experience, so to speak, that has made it so long-lived.
On our own little poll of best video games, I mean, it's Super Mario Brothers that's ahead. And that's really not a surprise, right? And I happen to know that our demographic, while younger than, say, Morning Edition, is not kids.
Right. Well, something like Super Mario Brothers kept millions of kids glued to their couches as they tried to solve the challenges. The thing that I'm proud about with the Oregon Trail being one of the finalists is that we are the only game that was designed specifically with an educational purpose in mind. And so kids had fun playing the Oregon Trail as a game, but they also learned as they did it.
Does mobile kill the video game in your view, or is it a whole new world of a Hall of Fame possibilities?
Well, it would be inevitable that there would be mobile versions, but I've always thought that the most effective use of the game, at least from an educational standpoint, was to have kids play it in a group. Put a group of four or five kids around a computer and have them simulate the experience of the family in the covered wagon and let them go through the kinds of discussions and decision-making that would have taken place.
Sounds great. You know, you learn something new every day. I did not know that the Oregon Trail passed through Evanston, Illinois, where I'm speaking to the co-creator of the Oregon Trail video game, Don Rawich. Don, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Don Rawich, co-creator of the Oregon Trail video game that could be inducted into the New World Video Game Hall of Fame from the National Museum of Play in Rochester, New York. Winners announced in June, but you can vote on your favorite video game at thetakeaway.org or just give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
This is Amanda from Austin, Texas. My favorite video games are anything by BioWare, especially Mass Effect and Dragon Age. Complete character facial customization, choices that affect gameplay for each following installment, really allows you to emotionally invest yourself into the game.
Hi, this is Ray from Newark, Delaware. I remember when Pong came out, it made my eyes hurt. I play pinball anytime I can. That's the best.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
Wendell Pierce, the actor known for his role as the cop Bunk in the HBO series The Wire, talks about his time in the city by the sea, and why the time is right now to address problems in a city that have been in place for generations.
The divisions in our communities are not happenstance. People should be outraged because they understand where it comes from. And if we really want to change it, we know what needs to happen. The same thing that you desire in your community is desired in that community. We cannot become desensitized to the fact that we watched a cop 2 weeks ago shoot a man in the back. We cannot become desensitized to the fact that someone rides away or runs away from the police, he's arrested, and his neck is broken. We cannot become desensitized to seeing someone who, in a struggle with the police officer, is videotaped in a chokehold and he dies, saying, "I can't breathe." And if we saw frat boys from Georgetown getting shot in the back by police, if we saw the girls of Bryn Mawr being choked to death by a police officer after a sleepover, this country would be outraged.
Just as the TV show Portlandia creates and perpetuates a mystery about Portland, Oregon, Miami Vice for Miami, Hawaii Five-O for Honolulu, the cable series The Wire told the real street stories of cops and criminals through the eyes of former reporter David Simon, real stories of Baltimore. They make Baltimore's modern reputation as a place of tough people trying to survive and the tougher people determined to keep them down.
I was a few years ahead of you at Edmondson, but I know you remember the neighborhood, how it was. We had some bad boys for real. It wasn't about guns so much as knowing what to do with your hands. Those boys could really rack. As rough as that neighborhood could be, we had us a community. Nobody, no victim who didn't matter. And now all we got is bodies.
It's Wendell Pierce playing Bunk Moreland, a murder detective on The Wire, with a seething anger about the changes he sees on his tough streets. Wendell Pierce, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you very much.
So I'm seeing different images in Baltimore. I'm wondering if you could relate to them. There is this sense of just bodies in the chaos, but there's also that sense of get back our community. There's that mom running around grabbing her son out of the rioters. I mean, it really is all of what The Wire was about, playing across the news footage.
Yeah, it's been a pretty remarkable week. I've been on an emotional roller coaster, actually, just hearing that scene and combining that with the images and what's been happening. It really affects me and touches me. For a decade, we examined the humanity of the people of that city and the dysfunction of policy and how it can be very destructive to people's lives. We were holding, as it were, a mirror up to nature, as Shakespeare says, and really demonstrating the power of what culture and art can be. What's unfortunate here is, even with that reflection about where we are as a society and the dysfunction, the one step we haven't taken is acting on it. And we watched it kind of explode in Baltimore this week.
So much of the scenes and the dialogue and the character interactions in The Wire is this kind of seething anger that occasionally explodes, but mostly is kept under control. How did it feel to see the out-of-control images in Baltimore?
Well, it was heartbreaking. It was heartbreaking. I know Pennsylvania. I know North Avenue. I know Montgomery Mall. And so it just, you know, it broke my heart. And the thing that we all have to realize is we can't pretend like we don't know why. Everyone, we've been answering the question why very, very astutely in a very complex manner. I thought, you know, one of the reasons we're celebrated as a television show on The Wire is because we answered those questions of dysfunction. I would say that the show The Wire wasn't just about cops and criminals. It was also about politicians and policy and its dysfunction. It was about the police department and its dysfunction. You know, the thing that I want to reiterate to people is we know why. You would know how you would react if placed in a cyclical environment of lack of opportunity, lack of education. People benefit in this country by keeping an underclass. We have to understand that it's generational. You know, redlining, which is making sure there's no insurance or economic development or opportunity, educational opportunity that we thought came about in some long ago, faraway place called Jim Crow, where you redlined a community, was actually memorialized in our laws, in our policy.
In some of your tweets over the past week, I sense a certain kind of frustration. For instance, these are not protesters. These are criminals disrespectful of the wishes of the family and people of goodwill. What would have been a great display of rage, you write, would have been going to the Department of Justice and demanding a meeting with Loretta Lynch on her first day. I sense you're trying to write a script that would be better than burning down the CVS this issue.
Yeah, because we all know, it's almost cliched. We know. 1968, the rage, we burned down the neighborhoods, and, you know, Watts, West Baltimore, Newark, all are still suffering from the damages of those neighborhoods. I think it would have been a different outcome had those kids gone to Roland Park and burned down. I think there wouldn't have been some sort of let's hold back and let them vent attitude if they had gone to Owens Mills and started burning down. As long as, you know, it's a poor community and there's outrage and it's burning down in a poor community, people kind of allow it to happen. We need to hear from people in Roland Park. We don't need to hear from the cast of The Wire. We need to hear from the people in Georgetown and the Upper East Side and Uptown New Orleans and hear the voices of people who say, you know, they may not look like me, they may not have much in common with me, but they are a part of my community too. The divisions in our communities are not happenstance, and people have to stop acting as if it's some sort of weird alien display of outrage. People should be outraged because they understand where it comes from, and if we really want to change it, we know what needs to happen. The same thing that you desire in your community is what is desired in that community.
Well, then, you know, where is this you know, where is this headed? I mean, on one level, you could say it's all unraveling and that those underground tensions and dishonesties and betrayals economically and in terms of criminal justice are finally reaching a boiling point, and that, you know, we're really devolving into a class war, and that's what America's going to be about in this century. Or other people say that, no, actually, we're getting more of an honest discussion, and it's going to be loud, and it's going to be violent sometimes, but this sense of awareness that actually this is coming into the surface, into the light, is what's going on here, and on the other side of this is something really positive. Do you have any sense of either of those outcomes or another of your own?
I choose the latter. I choose the latter, that we are lifting the veil of apathy. We're lifting the veil of selective ignorance about things happening. And we're exposing it and making sure that we give people an honest opportunity to either do something about it, but they know the alternative. I feel a little optimistic that we have an opportunity here because it's so clear that there's the demise of the American empire, as David Simon, my old boss, likes to say. People realize that it's not just a given that we are going to continue this sort of behavior and still succeed as a society. We're on a road of self-destruction, and that if we don't take the time, energy, effort, and resources, put resources into the greatest commodity that we have as a country, as a society, and that is its people. If we don't put our resources into our people, then we know that we're going to self-destruct.
Well, Wendell, thanks so much for speaking with me.
Thank you, John.
Wendell Pierce is an actor known for his role as Bunk Moreland in the HBO series The Wire and Antoine Baptiste in Tremé.
You've got to help me keep the devil down in the hole.
The Takeaway is supported by Citrix, creator of GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring a personalized meeting room for a custom look. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.